Hello and welcome to The World This Week with me, Gavin Lee, live in Paris every week with a panel of distinguished correspondents discussing the biggest events of the past 7 days. In a week that's seen Israel attempt a new plan to distribute food in Gaza, bypassing the UN and using American private contractors known as the Gaza Humanitarian Fund, the result, it was suspended on day one after looting, chaos and security measures were overwhelmed by desperate crowds. Meanwhile, the once steadfast support of Israel's key allies has seen a diplomatic erosion, private outrage turning to public condemnation.
Strikes in Gaza go beyond what is necessary to fight Hamas.
It's been a week that's seen a French doctor, Joël Lesquanec, thought to be the country's most prolific paedophile, sentenced to a further 20 years in jail. He's already in prison for other crimes. The 74-year-old former surgeon admitted abusing almost 300 people. Many were children under sedation in hospital who didn't know they'd been assaulted until they were told by police. Advocacy groups said that it exposed serious failings of French health authorities, accusing them of not caring to act when first made aware of his conviction for downloading images of child rape 2 decades previously.
Imprisonment with no chance of release. That's what this guy deserves. There are 299 victims here, and how many more will step forward?
It's been a week that Elon Musk said goodbye to the Trump administration and left his role at the White House. The world's richest man said his time had come to an end at the Department of Government Efficiency just days after his public critique of Trump's so-called big, beautiful tax bill, calling it too expensive and undermining the point of DOGE. Washington insiders said it was his time, quoting sources saying he'd been seen as a bit of a nuisance in Trump's inner circle. White House officials tell reporters he was, quote, off-boarded Wednesday night. Grok, what does off-boarded mean? There you go. The process of formally ending an individual's relationship with an organisation, according to HR and IT terms. Well, it was a week that also created an inadvertent legacy moment for Emmanuel Macron on manoeuvres in Southeast Asia, a moment likely to be included in every future look back at the president's career, a push in the face from the First Lady. Pay no attention to the couple behind the plane's curtain. Play fighting, said the president. We're going to take a closer look at what's been dubbed Le Slap.
Video can be made to say a lot of nonsense. In these three videos, I picked up a tissue, shook someone's hand and just joked around with my wife, as we often do. For me, it's been 3 weeks. If you look at the French president's international schedule, from Kyiv to Tirana to Hanoi, there are people who have watched videos and think that I shared a bag of cocaine, that I had a one-on-one with a Turkish president, and that right now I'm having a fight with my wife. None of that is true, yet those three videos are real. So everyone needs to calm down and to focus on the real news.
Well, let's introduce the panel tonight. Elisabeth Pinault, longtime Reuters correspondent covering the Elysee Palace in Matignon. Great to have you here, Elisabeth. The offices, of course, of the French president and the French prime minister. What a week to have your insight, Elisabeth. You're not a boxing commentator, are you? Given what's just happened in the past few days as well, it could be quite useful, some mixed martial arts ability. Just talk us through how quickly you found out and how quickly you were asked to say, this is urgent, this has gone up way off schedule.
Well, straight away, as soon as the very first second of this tour, you know, all the embassies and Macron's team had been working for this tour for months, for years maybe, and at the very first second, this image ruined everything. It went viral on the social media very quickly. We were, this happened during the night, Paris time, so, but very quickly we knew we had to write something. Nothing happened in a way. What could we say? But when in Hanoi, of course, the journalists asked the Élysée what happened, and at first Élysée said, well, nothing happened. They didn't even know we had images. What's going on? And then they did a proper sentence saying that they were just joking. So there was an official statement. And at this stage, we wrote something at Reuters, and everybody wrote something like Élysée is playing down what happened. And then, of course, it ruined the beginning of the tour. And then the couple tried to correct it. We don't know exactly what happened, and I'm not sure we will know exactly what was going on, really. But they tried to correct it by, joking, talking to each other. They did a little walk in Hanoi at night, even without press, saying that the couple was okay. And Macron answered, gave a long answer saying that it was fake news and that, the Russian and all the fake news people were trying again to say wrong things on the social media. But it was a bad episode for Élysée, quite typical of the time we are in, and also about this couple who has been observed from the very first second, because the difference of age, and Brigitte Macron and Emmanuel Macron have been there is an interest in this couple from the very beginning.
Well, I see media outlets and newspapers have brought in lip reading experts as well to try and decipher that conversation. We're going to try and decipher what was going on to our best ability tonight. But let's face it, I think the end of career moment, that's going to be on all of the kind of bloopers, the reels of your legacy, isn't it, for Mr. Macron?
Well, I think it's an image that will remain. But afterwards, of course, there was a long tour with many other messages, 26 billion contracts, deals. So he tried to talk about something else. But it's true that it's an image that will remain from the Macron couple about this, that will remain worldwide.
What won't really happen? Great to have you on board, Elizabeth. Also, the author of Le Vestiaire de Politique, The Political Locker Room, exploring the role of French fashion in politics. Let's also bring in Laura Kealy, defence correspondent for Politico Europe. Great to have you on the programme, Laura. Having spent your former journalistic life covering what went on inside the European Commission, nobody knows the Berlaymont quite like you, I imagine, Laura. The ins and outs covering tech regulation, investigative reporting too on European policy. A question I often ask panellists is your social media of choice. It looks like, I sense, X is not your immediate go-to anymore.
No, sadly, I had to turn to LinkedIn. Yeah. I tried to avoid that moment, but I think we all had it. It's also like you go where everyone goes. And now LinkedIn is kind of the blue sky hasn't quite picked up. It has in a way, but it's a bit niche. But yes, X, a lot of people have left X. And you can see in your feed that it's becoming less and less useful from a professional point of view. So definitely X is no longer something useful.
There used to be a time, didn't there, in Brussels, not too long ago, where journalistic scoops, feeds, they were all on X or Twitter. You never see that now.
No, like X was actually part of Twitter at the time, was actually part of your job. Like being visible on Twitter was important and you could reach out to people. It was, you could, like, people would make, politicians make announcements on X. And the Élysée is still on X. They still broadcast Macron's speeches on X. But you see less and less people, definitely.
They're still old school. Great to have you with us, Laura. Let's also bring in the studio Rina Bastis, senior editor at the US-based journal Al Monitor, heading up the Israeli Pulse section. Rina, great to have you back with us as well, focusing on Israeli politics and conflict in Gaza. And in her former life, Rina was a deputy ambassador to Bogota for Foreign Affairs Ministry. One thing I get a sense, when you work at Al Monitor, it puts out, the plan, its manifesto, unbiased original reporting. And I just wonder, in your efforts to be independent, is there an extra scrutiny upon you, or if you're reporting on Israel or elsewhere, expected of you to report in a certain way because you are a former Israeli diplomat?
No, I think my diplomatic career has been many, many years ago. And since then, I worked many years also as a correspondent for the Israeli public radio, which is more or less the equivalent of either the BBC or France Inter. So many years of journalism behind me. But it's true that Al Monitor is really putting the emphasis on we are an independent media. We have teams across the Middle East because that's our specialty. So we have journalists in Israel, of course, but we have also in several Gulf countries, in Egypt, in Jordan, in Morocco, in all over the place. I think that's extremely unique. There are very, very few media who have under the same roof Arab journalists, Palestinian journalists also and Israeli journalists. Mm. That's extremely rare, and that has been the case ever since Al Monitor was established some 12 years ago.
And probably extremely rare and unique to have a diplomatic background, to kind of get into their heads in a way that perhaps in other fields of journalism not everybody can.
Well, I hope it gives me some some edge. Of course, over the years, I mean, part of my interlocutors, part of the sources are obviously, and I think for many journalists dealing with geopolitics, you have to speak with diplomats. Yeah. So, of course, once you know the system from the inside, you can also understand better how they function, what they can tell, what they cannot tell, and why they cannot tell. So I think that sort of understanding really helps in the daily work when you're a journalist.
The lexicon of diplomacy. Great to have you with us as well. Let's also bring in Angela Diffley, France 24's International Affairs Editor. Angela, great to have you. Formerly back in the day with Radio France International, before that with the BBC. Angela, something you picked up this week is the accent of Emmanuel Macron appears to be changing.
Yeah, I certainly thought so. And I think maybe some other people have too. When you listen to that speech in Singapore, where he was talking about a lot of serious things, the French accent-speaking English was really heavy. And it wasn't like that before. He made a much bigger effort to get his R's right and his the sounds, you know, famously difficult sounds for French people, you know. And here he was laying on the z instead of the, and contrary instead of contrary or whatever, you know. I don't know if he has just decided, you know, I won't try too hard, or if, you know, I remember when I first arrived in France, sitting next to numerous people at dinner parties saying, is it true that it's really attractive for French people to keep their accent when they're speaking English? You know, I don't know what's going on. You might know Elizabeth. Better. And am I the only person who seems to think it's changed?
Well, I haven't noticed that much, really. But maybe it's because I'm French.
you were nodding, Laura.
Yes, yes.
I did notice today, specifically.
Yes, yeah, today. Maybe he was tired.
Tired. Exactly. That's
maybe he was tired. Sometimes he's tired now. He was not 7 years ago, but now, you know, 7 years after, he is. But at the same time, it can be, yeah, you're right, it can be just that he said, well, I'm French, and I'm not speaking French. I'm speaking English, but with French accent, yeah. because France is important and in this part of the world, and etc. And maybe somebody told him that. I don't know, but I can ask.
Very interesting.
It's not a bad thing. I just wondered motivated it.
But it's true that he could have chosen simply to speak French. I mean...
Yes,
leaders
yes,
do
it's
that.
Not a criticism.
When they are
just
like
curious.
In the
no,
UN.
But it's a good point, because I remember we were watching back earlier this week, back in 2019, when President Macron was speaking about Southeast Asia. His English was far more broken. He's definitely developed his ability in English, and I wonder if he's adding that French flair in a way that I had a producer in Brussels. When I used to ask him to voice things, he spoke perfect English with almost an accented English. He'd say, do you want me to do it in a really French way? Make it really flamboyant. So, you know, you can play with it, can't you?
But here at the Shangri-La, he had to speak English to be understood by everybody, for sure, because he did most of his speeches in French this week. But here at the Shangri-La, it really had to be understood as a French leader. By everybody. So, yes. Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe we'll never decipher it. Maybe we should ask.
I can ask about this French accent.
Voilà. Okay, well, let's first begin in Gaza on Tuesday. Israel's government rolled out its plan to distribute food in the Strip to bypass the UN using a newly created US-Israeli Gaza Humanitarian Fund, the GHF. Using private contractors in the south and centre of the Strip. Benjamin Netanyahu said the GHF could get food to Gazans without Hamas taking control of it. It was both started and suspended on the same day. The teams distributing the food cited riots and chaotic conditions. The boss, Jake Wood, quit, saying it was impossible to carry out the plan while adhering to the principles of humanity, neutrality, impartiality and independence. 24 hours later, the UN's World Food Programme said, quote, hordes of hungry people had broken into the supply warehouse, looting flour, cartons of food, gunshots fired. Two people were killed. The WFP said the humanitarian situation had now completely spiralled out of control. And then also on Wednesday, the Israeli Prime Minister confirmed that the IDF's airstrike on the European hospital in Khan Yunis 2 weeks previously had assassinated the latest Islamist leader, Mohammed Sinwar of Hamas, but continued Killing of civilians was losing Israel its steadfast support from allies. The UK, France, Canada threatening sanctions. Spain's prime minister called Israel a genocidal state. And this week, Germany's new chancellor said its actions are no longer justified.
I will now say it a little more clearly. What the Israeli army is doing in the Gaza Strip now, frankly, well, I no longer understand what the goal is. To involve the civilian population in such a way, as has increasingly been the case in recent days, can no longer be justified as a fight against the terrorism of Hamas.
Laura, let's begin with you on the ebbing away of vocal support from Israel's allies. Ursula von der Leyen talked about this week what she called abhorrent, and that's in EU language. You know, these are calculated, calibrated words carefully used, and also the voice of Friedrich Merz there. Germany, bear in mind, has sold a third of Israel's arms in the past 4 years, and suddenly now deciding whether to reassess in light of the humanitarian situation.
Germany's position is really a turning point, because countries such as Spain or Ireland or Sweden, it had been a few weeks, if not months, that they had been especially critical of the war on Gaza. But Germany, has been siding with Israel since the beginning, and now they're even saying this is no longer self-defense. It's not acceptable. As you said, the rethinking arms sales. And Ursula von der Leyen, she spoke after the Chancellor Merz. Usually she speaks after Berlin. But still, she still has weight. So this is really turning much more even than France or the UK, who had been kind of, you know, criticizing more and more. And the fact that Merz is from the CDU, so the conservatives, is even more important, because, again, the socialists, even under Olaf Scholz, could sometimes say, you know, it's too much, we don't accept, blah, blah, blah. But the German conservatives criticizing Israel, this is really, really a turning point.
And it's off the back of a recent visit from Friedrich Merz, to which Benjamin Netanyahu was kind of realigning the narrative afterwards, saying that when he came here, he understood that Hamas's equivalent, he said, attributing it to Merz, was like the Nazis, understands opposition here. This is calibrating that and saying, well, up to a point.
Yeah, exactly. The German government is saying, we don't accept this. Now we'll see if there will actually be actions or sanctions or stopping arms sales, etc. But for now, the words are very severe.
Angela, you've been looking at President Macron's, the end of his tour, the words that he's been using, and that's got him into trouble. Certainly a response, a real war of words now with the Israeli government.
Yeah, although I think, you know, what all of these leaders are saying is very much informed by what public opinion is pushing upon them. And that public opinion is very much informed by what's on our television screens. You know, I think it is astonishing how Israel appears to have resigned itself to completely losing the communications war on this, and you know, its decision at the beginning not to let independent journalists into Gaza. It said it was a security risk. It is true that sometimes journalists are taken hostage, and that really does create complications. Most journalists were very angry about it. That leaves a bit of a vacuum, some very brave Palestinian journalists, but it has to be said that Palestinian journalists are operating under terrifying conditions, Israeli bombs, mm-hmm. but also they are not able to give a full picture of what is going on. They are subject to the rule of violent authorities. Their families could suffer problems if they give a full round picture. And so the result is agonizing pictures. And it's very difficult for us to know what else is going on. Also, I think the Israelis themselves, if you look at apparently mainstream Israeli media, are not covering what is going on in Gaza, so I hear, properly. They're not showing those pictures. That, again, often happens in a war. You do not give your own country people much of a realistic picture of what is going on. It's true that Israelis have access to internet, but, you know, there's a language barrier and, you know, people don't always make the effort. So on every front, you know, the Israelis themselves don't appear to be fully informed of what is going on. And what impact is that having on their attitude to their government? And around the world, we are probably not getting a full picture. We are not also getting a full picture of Hamas, to what extent there is human shields going on. Mm. We know that in 2014 it was established that it did happen. This idea of aid being stolen, how, we don't know. We don't know. We have two versions. We have the Israelis and army's lies and government lies in wars. So we have two versions. The Israeli government saying a lot of it's getting stolen. Humanitarian agencies saying not very much of it is. We don't know. And at some point in a normal war, you would look at the suffering of your own people and make a decision about how much further to go on. And that question isn't really being asked of Hamas. It's the communications around this are... And also the immense spotlight on this war compared to other wars. You know, it's... and that is pushing leaders to say one thing in public and perhaps something quite different in private, and not doing very much on the concrete front either.
You raised two big issues there. One is the sense of a collective trauma, which I was talking to Rob Parsons about last week, back and forth to Israel, and actually what the Israelis are consuming politically in your everyday Israeli, and what they want to consume, the collective trauma off the back of October the 7th, whether there is that capacity to absorb what's going on in Palestine. I'm going to raise that with Rina in a moment. I want to first talk to you, Elizabeth, on the point about Emmanuel Macron, because the Israeli government today accusing the president of a crusade against the Jewish state. That was the terminology used. Take us behind the scenes a little bit, Elise, and a kind of what you're hearing diplomatically about a changing rhetoric.
Well, the thing, the new thing about Macron, who backed Israel at first very strongly after the October 7th, the new thing now is that Macron is considering recognizing a Palestinian state. And that's new, and of course, that's infuriating Benjamin Netanyahu. Emmanuel Macron talks to Benjamin Netanyahu a lot. I was told yesterday that he talks about him he's really just after Trump. Macron is the one who has him on the phone very often. So he knows that it's very tricky to say that, but he had this this joint comment to say that what's going on in Gaza is unacceptable a few days ago with Canada and Britain. That's new as well. And France is working with many other countries to try to find a way to lead to a two-state solution within a few weeks, heading to the conference on Palestine at the UN in June. Emmanuel Macron doesn't say that he's going there, because he will go there even if there's something to announce. So they are just diplomats are working on it. But of course, Israel is very annoyed with that. But Emmanuel Macron really he's supporting Israel, but at the same time, the Gaza images are just unbearable for the public opinion. Let's remember that France is home for the biggest Jewish community in Europe and the biggest Muslim community in Europe. So it's a matter of concern, everyday concern in France, really, on TV every day. And even in Asia, Emmanuel Macron talked about Middle East, about Gaza, in Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim country in the world.
And on those images that Elizabeth was talking about, going back to those points, to the extent that you're aware that, you know, you're in Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, how exposed to some of those images, the minutiae, the details we see in Europe, you're going to see on Israeli media channels across the board. Give me your take.
Well, a few things. First of all, yes, maybe the Israelis are not exposed enough, but I wouldn't say that they are not exposed at all to the images of Gaza. First of all, because the Israeli press is extremely free and bold. Even when you look at the press conferences, when Benjamin Netanyahu and the Prime Minister is convening press conferences, the journalists would ask him the sort of question that in France no journalist would dare to approach this way the country's leader. So the
like
press
what?
Is extremely, the press is extremely, the press could say, but Mr. Prime Minister, you are not telling the truth, for instance. I don't think any French journalist would say something like that to Mr. Macron.
Elizabeth? So,
well, why not?
It's a different, it's yes, a different, it's think? A different culture. It's a different way of saying things. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, the Israeli press is very free. But also, there is something else, which is the fact that hundreds and thousands of young Israelis serve in Gaza. So there you have testimonies coming directly to the people at home. They don't need even to pass by the press, because their sons or their daughters or their uncles or their fathers would tell them what they see. So this is a source of information that, on the contrary, Israelis are exposed to, but not us in Europe, or not the European press in any way, because, as you said earlier, there are no foreign journalists, almost no foreign journalists that
allowed
are present, that allowed the in the Gaza Strip. Having said that, the pictures we see when we talk about the war in Gaza, of course, there is some sort of, I don't want to say balance, but a lot of attention is paid to the hostages,
yes.
to the 58 hostages we still have, still are held in the band of in the Gaza Strip. We think, we hope, we believe that 20 of them are still alive. So a good part of the coverage goes to all these manifestations, all these demonstrations, all these rallies taking place in Israel since October 8, calling for the release of the hostages. So when the journalists are covering the Gaza war, evidently part of the time will be dedicated to that.
Let me pick up on something else you've been looking at this week, which is how close a ceasefire might be. Let's have a look at your article, in fact, this week that you touched upon it. It seemed to be Steve Witkoff, Mr. Fix on Foreign Affairs for Donald Trump, seemed to be suggesting it was almost there. Israel are on board, and yet Hamas kind of throwing kind of cold water at the same time, quote, they are seriously reviewing it. So how close do you think?
Yeah, earlier this week we had a feeling that really it's a matter of hours, that Mr. Trump, he said even, or his aide said, that the moment it's reached, the moment it's signed, the agreement, then Trump will be the one making the big announcement. We were really waiting for that. It did not happen. I have to say, this proposal of Steve Witkoff, it's not a new proposal. I mean, it's very similar to the same proposal we had on the table for several months ago. There is a little change. For the families of the hostages, it's a big change that instead of having 10 hostages released immediately on the first day, we will have 5 released on the first day and 5 released on the seventh day. But the whole idea of having 2 months of a ceasefire and during that period to negotiate the second phase, this is not something new, and for the moment, Hamas is not accepting it.
Well, I guess what's new is it will be a longer period than either of the two previous ceasefires. 60 days are talking about. The other thing that Hamas appears to be, from the many of the drafts that seem to be circulating, there's less of a concept of the UN continuing its distribution, to which Hamas says they want to go back to that, not using the Gaza Humanitarian Fund. There's kind of fudged languages that are on that. And also what happens after, the day after, the idea of a permanent ceasefire. Hamas said if there's not that there, they're not signing up to it, to which Israel says, well, hang on, what if Hamas re-emerge? What if militarily give out Kalashnikovs? We have to have the right to go back into Gaza. So that seems to be part of the sticking point too, doesn't it?
The ending of the war, that's the big, big sticking point from the beginning. From the beginning.
Yeah.
And that's why I think in this proposal that Steve Witkoff put on the table, he sort of managed to put a formula that should, which is vague enough, that should have maybe satisfied both sides, because Prime Minister Netanyahu says he will continue fighting until Hamas no longer has military and governing capabilities. Hamas, on the other side, says, no, we want to have assurances, we want to have guarantees from the Americans, from the Qatari, from the Egyptians, that the war will completely stop. This is not working, of course, these two goals, these two objectives. So Steve Witkoff put some sort of a vague phrasing that should accommodate both sides, but for the moment, Hamas is not accepting.
Yeah, some kind of collective ambiguity. Very briefly, do you think you and I will be talking, if the world this week, next week, there'll be a ceasefire?
I really hope so, because it seems that the American president is really putting a lot of pressure on both sides. It's become a matter of almost of honor for him, I think, to reach that in his quest for a Nobel Prize, maybe at some point. So if he wants a Nobel Prize, he needs to get the accord signed.
Okay, from one attempt of a ceasefire to another, what appears to be an attempt of a ceasefire in Ukraine, where the week began with two consecutive nights of unprecedented air assaults. First Saturday, sirens rang out across Kyiv from midnight as Russia, with 250 drones and 14 ballistic missiles, began the largest combined aerial attack on the capital in 3 years of war. A reported 50,000 people spent the night in underground metro stations. The next night, even worse, 355 drones, 9 ballistic missiles fired across 30 Ukrainian towns and cities. It was the largest onslaught in a single day on civilian areas. At least 25 people killed, dozens injured. Russia's claim is it hit military targets. Well, within hours, President Trump gave his view. It was a rare rebuke. He called Putin crazy on social media and again to reporters on the runway in front of Air Force One, a tamer version of the same thing.
Yeah, I'll give you an update. I'm not happy with what Putin's doing. He's killing a lot of people, and I don't know what the hell happened to Putin. I've known him a long time, always gotten along with him, but he's sending rockets into cities and killing people, and I don't like it at all, okay? We're in the middle of talking, and he's shooting rockets into Kiev and other cities. I don't like it at all.
President, what do you want to do about that?
I'm surprised. I'm very surprised. We'll see what we're going to do. What am I going to tell you? You're the fake news, aren't you?
Against the backdrop of these attacks, paradoxically, there was a rare moment of cooperation, three-day prisoner swap, the largest so far, 1,000 Ukrainian prisoners, soldiers, civilians, bused to Chernihiv on the border with Belarus, back to their families, some chanting, long live Ukraine, others barely able to speak. And the same number of Russian prisoners released in Belarus, and Russia's deputy defence minister was there orchestrating a family call in front of Russian media for an unnamed soldier.
Hello, Natasha. We've been exchanged. Everything is normal. Well, do not worry. Everything is okay.
Let's go back to you and start again with Germany, the Chancellor making headlines for a very different shift to his predecessor regards to Ukraine.
Yeah, there are hopes that Germany could deliver the long-range cruise missiles known as Taurus. First, he said that there would be no limit to the range that Ukrainians could hit with the weapons that they have. And then there is this potential change about the Taurus missiles. Germany also announced a $5 billion package to Ukraine with long-term arms-making cooperation on top of potential donations. So, yes.
What difference could it make, lifting the restrictions on long-range weapons?
Honestly, not that much. Really? That's kind of what military experts have been saying, is that it's a nice to have, but that's not what could tip the balance in favor of Ukraine, because the problem is more about Russia has more people, has a production apparatus that produces much more, so Russia has more means to last. That's kind of the problem, and Ukraine no longer has military aid from the United States. So that's the difference between the two. It's not about, I mean, it's always useful, but that's not what would help Ukraine win the war.
So it's the ability to hit further installations that are creating perhaps the factories for drones, for the missiles. But as you say, it helps with defense, but it's not helping to reshape.
And they don't have enough missiles. I mean, we don't know the exact numbers because obviously that's part of the strategic ambiguity, but they don't have as many as Russia. That's the problem. Also, it's mass. They don't have as many weapons.
Angela, to Istanbul on Monday, where we're set to have the second round of peace talks. Ukraine saying it's waiting for the terms and conditions that has been promised from Russia. They expect that they'll be the same again, to what they call denazify the government, essentially get rid of the government and demilitarise and take more territory as well. What's your thought around where that takes us? Is that a must-see moment? And also on President Trump's comments recently about a kind of deadline.
Yeah, a kind of deadline. You know, we've seen kind of deadlines before. It does look, I mean, I'm an observer. It does very much look as though the Russians drag everything out until they can't drag it out any longer. Then they make a small incremental step towards looking as though they're interested in peace. So the last time in Istanbul, after those talks were downgraded, we all thought they were going to be much higher level. They turned out to be at a much lower level. Zelensky, who had turned up, then flew to Albania instead, and it was all conducted at a much lower level. They said at the end of those talks, we will come up with a memorandum with our vision of long-term peace. As you say, it will be that. It won't have changed very much. It didn't look as if it was going to materialise at all until the pressure was stepped up again a little last week from Trump after that big attack at the weekend when he appeared to be losing patience. So now we have this meeting on Monday, but a lot of military analysts looking at what's going on at the ground say it is very clear that the Russians are preparing a summer offensive, and it looks like this is all foot-dragging.
To use a crude term, that they're softening up, ready for it. Elizabeth, there's an odd deja vu here, isn't there? Because it was the start of this month that we heard of this two-hour conversation between President Trump and Putin. Rewind 3 years. There was a two-hour, 10-minute conversation reported, kind of similar terms of dialogue with President Macron and President Putin after the war had broke out, where they were kind of, let's just use a term I heard, which is this: I'm ready for dialogue, I'm ready to sit down with the Ukrainians. And yet, here we are all that time on.
Well, the problem here is Putin from the very beginning. Macron at first tried to speak to him. He did for several months even, and he got nothing. Trump said he would end the war within 24 hours by talking to Putin and solve everything with him. And he had some kind of admiration for him, and he went nowhere. All eyes are in Istanbul next Monday, but now we know that even the Ukrainians don't want to go there because they need some guarantees that something will be signed, something acceptable will be discussed, but apparently they don't even have this. So, and every night, every morning we had the we hear that there's been a huge attack of the Russians against Ukraine. So and Macron tries to persuade Trump that he has on the phone several times a week that that he shouldn't be blinded by Putin, that Putin is a liar. He said that clearly. But
and what does Trump say back?
Well, Trump says he's not very clear himself, because he says he had him on the phone, and he said he doesn't seem to know how to handle things, really. And of course, he's unpredictable. He changes his way of taking the problem. But the problem is Putin from the very first. If Putin doesn't want to do a single effort, it can lead nowhere, really.
Strikes me, and be interesting whether there's a view on this, and you're hearing anything different from the elite, say. Jeffrey Goldberg, the Atlantic editor behind Signalgate, that story that fell onto his lap, the scoop of the year, being in that Signalgate group chat while there was a bombing of Yemen. Now, he spoke about being invited to meet President Trump and saying, after all of the hostility on social media and on TV, he was nice as pie. He was charming in person. Do you sense the relationship with President Trump and Macron personally is very different, kind of the public portrayal that Trump puts out of Macron, often mocking him, perhaps playfully?
You mean the relationship between Macron and Putin?
Private? No, Macron and Trump privately.
Macron, they know each other. Macron was there for the first Trump term. He's the only one with the Chinese Xi to be. He was there at first, so he's supposed to know him well. But I think they have some kind of personal relationship. We can remember when he took Trump for July 14th on the Champs-Élysées, and then Melania and Donald having dinner at the Eiffel Tower. But that was a few years ago. I think this time, this second term is definitely tougher. The world have changed, but at the same time, Macron is got, I think, a relationship, some kind of relationship with Trump, but that really does not really work because Trump has decided that Europe was not a friend of the US anymore, and Macron has got problems to convince him of the contrary. He's trying, but he keeps trying. That's Macron, you know. He keeps trying, and he prevents himself from saying, from talking badly about Trump. They always is always very careful about the US. US is our ally. Whatever Trump says, he's very careful of what he says. It's not the same with Putin.
Very interesting, another fact that perhaps is not revealed publicly up until today. Rina, your take on this, and probably Laura as well off the back of that, which is that reports came out today by the BBC that fossil fuel money from the EU to Russia had actually outspent on gas, predominantly, the aid given to Kyiv. And therefore, to recalibrate, actually, well, you're trying to have a message at the same time spending all of that money to allow that military operation to keep going. That's an odd paradox, isn't it?
It is. And I'm thinking, I was a few months ago at a press conference at the Defense Ministry here in Paris. And this whole press conference was about how France does not have the capacity. It's not that they don't want to produce all the weapons that the Ukrainians want. They just, they can't afford it. So once you introduce all of these economic features inside, and you have also the deals, and you have the fuel, and you have the fact that Europe is incapable of helping Ukraine as much as Ukraine needs, then you wonder where it is going. And I wanted also, I liked a lot the analysis that Elizabeth did earlier on, and your question about the all the ultimatums that Trump was putting on the table. And in a way, because we saw it also on Gaza, that Trump was, he kept saying there will be hell to pay if Hamas does not concede, if Hamas does not release the hostages. And we've seen also with Ukraine the same thing. I mean, he was saying first the 24 hours ultimatum, and then the 2 weeks ultimatum or not, sort of ultimatum. Now, and in a way, I think for Putin, this means not that Trump is a strong person, but on the contrary, if you put so many ultimatums on the table, if you keep putting ultimatums on the table, you are not strong, you are weak. And this is, yes, of course, playing badly for the Ukrainians.
And just a quick word, Laura, because you've covered Brussels for years. Was it a surprise to you, that figure coming out today, how much was being spent to Russia?
It's not the first time that there's an awareness also on gas that the Europeans are still very, very reliant on Russia.
But outspending aid to Ukraine.
Yeah, that's not great. but you see that they are aware, the European Commission and European countries, because you've seen them in the past few years that they're trying to diversify supply. They're going to Central Asia and even the United States, promising to buy more gas. So I wouldn't say that it's, I don't think it would be a surprise to them, but it takes time to, yeah, when you've relied on Russia for such. And there's also this thing where Russia sells oil to other countries and then they resell to Europe, and it's like at some point they're trying to diversify, but when even the other suppliers are in cahoots with Russia, then it becomes kind of difficult. And just maybe to what you said about Gaza and Ukraine, I think there's one difference is that Trump would be ready to leave the table on Gaza, not Gaza, Ukraine and Russia. But not necessarily on Gaza and Israel. And Marco Rubio, the U.S. Secretary of State, he said a few weeks ago, like, we're trying with Putin and Zelensky, etc. But if you guys don't agree on a peace, then it's not our problem anymore. Yeah. So that's a risk.
Yeah. Going back to your point about the Abraham Accords, about deals with Iran, and therefore the greater goal that many talk about, the Nobel Peace Prize for Trump. Well, to the Oval Office Wednesday, when President Trump, the man with a well-documented habit of coining nicknames for both friends and foe, think Mark, Little Marco, Crooked Hillary, Sleepy Joe, etc. Well, he found out the one Wall Street uses for him, courtesy of CNBC reporter Megan Casella.
Other analysts have coined a new term called the taco trade. They're saying Trump always chickens out on your tariff threats, and that's why markets are higher this week. What's your response to that?
I kick out?
Chicken out.
Oh, then I chicken out. I've never heard that. You mean because I reduced China from 145% that I set down to 100 and then down to another number? Because I I gave the European Union a 50% tax tariff, and they called up and they said, please, let's meet right now. We had a country people didn't think it was going to survive, and you ask a nasty question like that.
He went on to say, don't ever say what you said, which is surely the last thing to say if you don't want to get stuck with a nickname. This week also saw the Court of International Trade temporarily block large chunks of President Trump's signature tariff plan, the one he launched in the Rose Garden when he read through a list of the worst offending countries and matched the import duties to the unfairness level his team thought it justified. The ban, since temporarily lifted, will be fought out in the courts. Then on Wednesday, Elon Musk unceremoniously quit his advisory role to the president after 129 days, a conscious uncoupling, one day short of the limit imposed on special government employees, leaving the Department of Government Efficiency, with this announcement on X. Nothing to see here. My scheduled time is over. We are expecting later this evening a press conference both with Elon Musk and President Trump. We'll bring you that as it happens. But just before he went, he took a polite pop at President Trump's self-titled big, beautiful bill for tax cuts for families and businesses. Critics say Trump's plan will significantly increase national debt. And Musk appeared to agree.
So, you know, I was like disappointed to see the massive spending bill, frankly, which increases the budget deficit, not just decrease it, and undermines the work that the Doge team is doing.
I actually thought that when this big, beautiful bill came along. I mean, like, everything he's done on Doge gets wiped out in the first year.
I think a bill can be big or it can be beautiful, but I don't know if it can be both. My personal opinion.
OK, let's start with you, Angela. Let's start with Taco Trump. It's got a stick, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, whilst you could say for his foreign policy, this characteristic unpredictability can sometimes be useful. Not always, but occasionally it's useful. The trouble is, once we all know he operates like that, it's much less effective. But it's never been that effective when you're talking about Wall Street and money markets, which is where this term was coined. Mm. Uncertainty, we all know, they don't like it. And he does blink when particularly the bond markets are showing signs of distress. So, yes, it will stick. In terms of the Elon Musk thing, I, you know, you really get the impression he used Musk, really, to do a lot of difficult work, make a mess of it or not. Again, the spaghetti thing, see what sticks, see what doesn't. And when it's not working out anymore, we will go our separate ways. And it does look like, you know, yes, Elon Musk got some stuff out of it. He has regulations into some of his operations, have now regulatory boards have now disappeared, or they're not looking at stuff that might have been inconvenient for him. He did get a few upsides to it. But broadly, you know, we all know Tesla is in huge trouble, and that, I think, will last. You know, they'll have to find a new name and do something very drastic. So I think he came off worse out of it.
I'm going to mention Elon a bit more in a moment because there's a few factors to talk about with Elon. One of the issues I want to talk about with you, Elizabeth, is this tariff plan. The Rose Garden moment seems to be kind of up in the air. The idea that the courts had said that this is overstretched to some degree, that the president does have right to deliver what he set out. It's no surprise to people that he was going to bring in tariffs. Let's face it, that's what he said. But the fact that it's now on pause, and we go back to what Angela was talking about, which is this kind of Taco mentality, he'd prefer to say the wild man theory. This book's been written about this, that he's unpredictable, not a chicken, that he could go anywhere. And I just wonder to which this is now to Europe's advantage, that the tariffs are kind of being controlled to an extent or being overseen by the courts.
Well, Europe tried to stay calm, which is not easy because it is unpredictable and economy hate that. But what I notice is that, yeah, Europe is especially calm. You know, they don't respond whatever he says. He said last week that it would be 50%, just a nightmare for luxury, champagne, brandy, everything in France. But Macron did not, you know, react. They just let Brussels pick up the phone and talk to the trade counterpart in Washington. Then Trump went back. So on the whole, Europe tried to be clever and not to react every time and try to negotiate. The next step, I think, is July the 9th. That's the next deadline for tariff for Europe. So they try to negotiate, to try to have something from him. But at the same time, I think tariff is one thing, economy is one thing, but the U.S. policy is different. Time have changed. Even if he changes his mind all the time, Europe knows that something has changed in its relationship with the U.S. For instance, for defense, Europe now knows that it has to be independent on its defense. So whatever he says, and even if he changes his mind all the time, a new era has come, and I think Europe is aware of that.
On the issue of Musk, Laura and Rina, I want to give you 30 seconds each on this before we go on to talk about the viral moment of the week and Southeast Asia tour, which is your impression of 129 days. Phil, there's a documentary there of what actually happened in that time, of the legacy of Musk. He came in with a chainsaw, went out maybe with a bit of a fizzle. Rina.
Yeah, well, the chainsaw is a very good example, reflecting exactly, I think, period, because when he brought it on the scene, what was his idea? He wanted to show I'm efficient, I do things quickly, out of the box, you'll see, we'll reduce all the expenses, everything that is not really needed. But at the end of the line, this saw has become a symbol, I think, of cruelty, of people being laid without any reason, very quickly, in a terrible way, and even endangering the society, because he laid hundreds of flight controllers just like that. I mean, can you imagine the consequences if he would not have retracted that, or firing hundreds of controllers of nuclear installations? So I think the legacy would be quite a negative. And also we look at the numbers. I mean, he promised that he would cut $2 trillion of the state budget. I think he cut around 75 billion, and even that sum, when you look at all the appeals, all the claims that would that are ready against him, I think people asking for compensations because they were fired illegally. By the end of the line, I mean the budget could actually go up instead of going down.
Laura.
Yeah, it started a few months ago as like a win-win relationship where Musk would bring Trump voters and Trump would bring Musk like the ear of the president of the United States. And now a few months later, the MAGA base, like the Steve Bannon, etc., they treat Musk as like a globalist, so like the enemy. So with the voters, he's not even popular. And Musk's business has suffered a lot from the association with Trump. So now it's kind of a lose-lose relationship.
OK, so let's reverse to the end of the programme, go back to the beginning where we started. A quick word on what is clearly the viral moment of the week, overshadowing the Southeast Asia tour. Just impressions on Macron. I want to get Angela and Laura first. Gen Z might call it casual pookie talk, which is kind of like friendly banter between them. Is this going to haunt him for a while, to try and get what happened?
I think there are a few kind of noticeable things about it. One is the French media reluctant to go there, the mainstream media. And I don't think that is necessarily a bad thing. It's obviously a legacy of, the private life, public life, the very sharp divide that there used to be in France. Obviously, that can no longer exist in an age of social media. But the French mainstream media were very reluctant to go there and only decided to really when it was unavoidable.
In the time that we have, are you convinced, in a word, yes or no, with the reason given so far?
No, but he shouldn't have given any reason. He shouldn't have spoken. He should have...
You were their press. That's what you'd have advised. Laura?
They didn't really give a reason. They said they were squabbling, but about what? That's the reason.
Rina, I'm sure the Israeli press would have dealt with that differently. With
Yes, although I agree. I think he should have just said, I'm sorry, it's private, it's none of your business, and cut it like that.
And to which we know, Elizabeth, you're still digging away. Great to have you all on board. Up next, we're going to hear live from Elon Musk and President Trump. But thank you for watching. Thank you to our guests today, Laura Caeli, for the political correspondent, the defence correspondent at Politico, Angela Diffley, France 24's international affairs editor, Rina Bastis at Al Monitor, and also Elizabeth Pinault, friend of the programme from Reuters. We will see you in 7 days for The World Next Week.